Okay. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this opportunity we have to be together. We are so thankful for the love and the grace that you continue to bestow upon us. We realize that it is in your wisdom that you established the family, the husband and the wife. We realize, Father, that all things were created for our good. As we study your will, Father, may we be ever mindful that we need to try to follow your word, your wisdom, and that we might grow in service to each other, both within and without of the family relationship. We thank you for the church and for the opportunity we have to be here this morning. It's through your son's name that we pray. Amen. So we're going to finish up our study of authority in the husband-wife relationship. And as we've talked last week, this may not be the most politically correct subject in today's society. And yet we understand we're not here to please man. We are here to please God and look at what God's will is for the husband-wife relationship. We talked about the fact that the man, while being given the authority within the relationship, it is not inherently his authority, right? We understand that the man has been given delegated authority. God, as our creator, inherently has authority. And who did he first give that authority to? Before he even gave it to me, he gave it to the son. The son came and he had delegated authority, and then that authority was passed on to the apostles. And yet in the family relationship, God delegated that authority to the man. So husbands, the authority is not because of your own innate goodness or greatness. That authority has been delegated to you by God. And then we looked at, how does that authority look? When Jesus came, what did he do with his authority? What was his main focus? Kelly? Serve. To serve. We looked at just one example when the day before Jesus was going to be betrayed, he washed the apostles' feet, even those of Judas. He served. So the idea that you've been given this delegated authority, what do you do with it? Well, what is the common analogy that the Bible makes about how the husband-wife relationship should look? What's it based off of? The church, Christ and the church. So that is the analogy that is commonly brought forth in the scriptures of how the husband-wife relationship should work. So we looked at the idea of service. We looked at Ephesians chapter 5 and the husband-wife relationship, and we talked about the fact, is man's authority based off of he's the better equipped to have that authority? Is that what this is based off of? No. It's not because of the man's innate ability to lead versus the woman. It is his explicit responsibility. Whether the man wants to or not, he has been called out specifically by God to be the leader in the husband-wife relationship. Because what happens when there is no leader? Chaos. So it is man's inherent responsibility, whether he likes it or not. Because again, the relationship and the roles in the relationship are not based off of the qualifications of the people involved. It is God's plan for the man to be the leader in the husband-wife relationship. So we look at those things. We talked about the idea that in order for a woman to submit, what does that submission look like? Is that simply a matter of she does what the husband says? No. How does she submit? Is it a reverent submission? When we see the son submitting to the father, what did that look like? Was that a begrudging, I'll do it only because that's what the father wants? Or did we see Jesus submit in reverence and respect? So there is a difference in submitting in our terms and submitting in what the biblical idea of submission was. And in order for a woman to submit to her husband, who does she have to submit to first? She has to submit to God. She's never going to be able to successfully submit to her husband until she's submitted herself to God. And by same token, what is a man commanded to do? Is he commanded to rule his wife? Love. And before he's going to be able to love his wife in the manner that God intended, who does he have to love first? He has to love God, because he's never going to be able to love his wife in the manner that God intended if he doesn't love God first. That's the only way that's going to happen. Okay. We had left off last Sunday. We had talked about the idea of a woman being treated as a weaker vessel. We looked at some different ideas of what that might mean. I think we all kind of agreed that looking at her as a weaker vessel was the idea that it's not a physical, spiritual, or emotional idea of being a weaker vessel, but handle with care. The message from the Creator, when God created Eve, handle with care, or you're going to answer to me. Because we see that what is the ramifications of not treating your wife as a weaker vessel? What does Peter say the ramifications are? Prayers be hindered. And by synecdoche, or a part put for the whole, what does that mean? Does that mean, well, I can worship God and be in good service to him, except he's just not going to hear my prayers? I think by extension, we can all understand that your entire worship is affected. Your relationship with God is affected if you do not treat your wife this way. And so you just, men, just ask yourselves, is that how you treat your wife? Is that how you think? This is God's gift to me. And how do you treat that gift? And in that light, that's what we're going to pick up this morning. Husbands, when we make decisions that affect our wife and our family, what is the framework by which we make those decisions? So we're going to look at an example this morning. If you think about Lot in Genesis chapter 13. So Abraham and Lot could no longer live in the same area. And so a decision had to be made about where to live. And so Lot made his decision based on what? Good land, material gain, right? So he makes the decision. What did he not take into consideration? The environment that he was going to live in, right? He made a decision strictly based on the idea of material gain and being able to further his physical wealth. And what did that decision cost him? Everything, right? It cost him his wife. It cost him his family. It says he was oppressed. Now, here's the question. Was Lot a good man? How do we know that? It says he was righteous, right? It also says it in 2 Peter. We'll just turn over real quick to 2 Peter chapter 2. Verse 6, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. So here's a good man, a righteous man. Did he make a bad decision? He did, right? He made a bad decision. And this bad decision wasn't just a next day consequence. This was a bad decision with massive consequences. Does that have application to us today? When husbands, when you think about, hey, I've got a new job or a promotion, or maybe we're going to move to a different area, what's the first thing you think about? Is it the cost of living? How much more am I going to be making? Is there a good church in the area? Are there fellow saints that I'm going to be able to work and worship with? Am I going to be able to continue the spiritual growth of myself and my family in this area? Are those the things that we consider? And it's not just about moving. It's really any decision that you make. What about time? What about taking on a second job? Is that going to impact the spiritual welfare and the wealth of your family? A lot of times, and I would reckon with this audience, it's not so much taking a second job, it's what about your hobbies, your activities, taking on additional responsibilities in the secular world, whether it be fun or otherwise? Is every decision that you make, small to large, does it take into consideration how is this going to affect my wife and my kids in a spiritual environment? And is this the best decision for that? And I'm not saying every decision has that impact, but is it not something worth considering when we start making decisions? We are the leaders of the family. And when we exercise that authority, are we viewing it in that frame? Now, wives, what about, we know ultimately what happened to Lot's wife, but let's think about this for a minute. Your husband makes a bad decision. A bad decision. How do you handle it? Is your husband ungodly? Do you criticize him for that bad decision? Do you constantly remind him that he made a bad decision? Does it become the point that you constantly bring up in further conversation? Well, yeah, remember you did this. What about the time you did that? Because we talked about the idea of being in submission isn't simply accepting what your husband tells you to do. It's how you accept it. Do you remember the story of David and Abigail? Do you remember Abigail's husband, Nabal, was a bad guy. He was a bad guy, and he didn't receive David's envoy in the manner that it was intended. In fact, he treated him very harshly. And so what was David's response? I'm just going to wipe him out. David was a military man. And who was it that interceded on the behalf of Nabal and their family? It was Abigail. Now, why do I bring that up? What in the world does that have to do with David and Abigail weren't even married at this point? The point is, did David, now here's David with his entire army with him, and here's this woman that comes to him to intercede on behalf of her family. Did David listen to her? He did. He did listen to her. Husbands, do you consider your wife's input when you're making these types of decisions? Do you value her input? Even a better question that maybe you ask when you get home, does your wife think that you value her input? Does she feel like she has a voice in decisions that are made? Because if we look over in the book of Esther, we have a little bit of a different example. Do you remember how the king reacted whenever his wife would not appear at the banquet? How did that go over? And what was his method of operating as far as whether you could even approach him? He would have to extend the scepter. So men, do we take it as a point of pride that I'm the man? I'm going to make the decisions here. I'm the boss. This macho image of I'm the guy that makes decisions. And I don't think anybody in this room would admit to saying that's how I am. And I'm not proposing that you are, but I would ask you to seriously ask your spouse, do you think I value your input? What's the root cause of the idea of a man not listening to his wife, of simply making the decisions on his own? We've talked about this kind of as a thread throughout, not just this class and others, but what's the root cause of a man saying, I'm not listening to my wife, I'm making the decisions here? Pride. Pride. It's at the root of so many problems. It's pride. And yet that's even in 2021, at least from my personal experience, there's still a lot of men out there that they view themselves as the king. And they're the ones that are going to make the decisions. And they really don't care if their wife agrees with them or not. That's just how things are. We all know of the terrible misuse of authority in the example of David and Bathsheba. We know that David was the king. And he used his authority. In fact, if you look in the chapter in 2 Samuel, if you look at the verbs that are included in the things that he did, he used that authority to send, to call. He was manipulating and moving things around because he had the authority to do so, to end up having Uriah murdered and to end up having Bathsheba. That's a gross example, right? A gross example of a misuse of authority. And yet, I believe it's applicable to our relationships with our wives. Are we using our authority for our own benefit? Are we making decisions that benefit us? Or are we making decisions that benefit our wife for their good? Because remember, we looked at the idea of how are men supposed to love their wives as themselves. And we talked about the idea that when you hurt your wife, as the two have become one, and you hurt your wife, who are you really hurting? You really are hurting yourself. You're hurting them, but it's a negative impact upon yourself as well. It's really a mindset. Maybe that's the best way to sum this up. It's a mindset. When you are making decisions or when you are considering decisions, are you valuing the input of your wife? Are you looking at the wisdom that she brings to the table and evaluating that and then making the decision that you understand may not be the best decision for yourself? You may not be the one most favorably impacted, but you're doing what is best for your wife. That's what God expects. Yeah.
So many things. I think of the snowball effect. And, you know, once a man says, I'm going to do this, one little thing here, and I don't really care, it just goes downhill from there. And, you know, because if he does it once, he's probably going to do it again, and it's just going to get a bigger and bigger problem. And that's never good.
And is that easy to do? Guys, is it real easy to be like, hey, I made a mistake. Sorry about that. I'll do better next time. Is that, I don't know, maybe I'm pointing the finger at myself too much. That's not always easy to do. To say, yeah, I messed up on that. But I think Jeff's point is valid. Once you establish a pattern of the relationship within your home, that's typically the road that you go down. Inertia is a hard thing to change, right? And here's what happens. If you establish a pattern that I'm going to make decisions regardless of your input or regardless of whose benefit, after a certain amount of time, what is going to happen? Well, either one of two things. Either the wife is simply going to understand that she has to submit. It's not her job to try and make you make decisions. We talked about that, right? We talked about so many relationships are, I'll submit if you love me. And I'll love you if you submit. But that's not the way God intended it. So either the wife is going to submit and she's just going to stop offering her input. And the relationship is going to just eventually not die, but it becomes you're living together alone. She's just going to stop trying to provide that input. Or what's the other possibility? It blows up. It blows up. But either way, once that pattern is established, it's very difficult to break. Now, by the same token, on the good side, if you establish a pattern of considering your wife's input. So guys, let me just ask you a question. How many of you proactively approach your wife for input? How many of you say, before I make this decision, I need my spouse's input? That gets you a lot further, by the way. And usually what you find, and what I've found over my almost 30 years, she has some really good ideas. She has some really good things to say. She has a viewpoint that we as men sometimes don't consider. She can offer insight that I never thought about. Now, do I make the decision that she, if we differ, do I make the decision that she offers? Sometimes. Sometimes I don't. But what I'm telling you is, having learned stubbornly, having been married so young, to go to her and ask her for her input, what do you think about this, has helped me tremendously. Sean. Right.
Although that happens. But I know I've got to be careful about that, because it can happen on a more lighthearted topic where she's kind of rolling around like, okay. But then there have been more serious ones where I just feel the need, like I'm playing, like I'm trying to get her input, but I'm so set on what I'm trying to do that I've seen it talk about this other one or now. And that, I think, will get to the same effect eventually. Like, even if you ask her for input, as you said, it's for naught. She knows that it's just for show. But that's kind of my, I've felt in that area, I think. Beating them down.
I definitely, this was an area of growth, and I continue. And I do feel like that now, if I'm going to make a decision of any importance, I do seek her input. I do want to know what she has to say. I do want to know how she feels about it. And by the same token, how she responds if I choose ultimately not to go with her opinion is a responsibility that she has and how she accepts that. Rod.
Yeah, we like to play games with husbands. When you asked a question a moment ago, I took the question a little different. When you ask it, it's difficult to say you're sorry. Sometimes it's too easy to do that. And you say you're sorry, and you know, but somebody asks, when you're asked to be forgiven, they got to forgive you, right? And you move on and you feel good, and you fail to realize that there's been some damage. There's some carnage there that, there'll be more in a couple weeks. And a lot of this overlaps what you already said, but I think sometimes we do play these games. We don't maliciously play games with the different personalities with our wives, but we do it.
And every relationship is unique. And so my relationship with Jennifer, no one understands my relationship with Jennifer better than me and Jennifer. And no one understands your relationship between you and your spouse than you and your spouse. And so I can relay and I can talk about the things that I understand between me and Jennifer. And hopefully each of you, as you sit in the audience and you think about the concepts that we're talking about, the applications that you're making in your mind, you could probably turn and look at your spouse right now and they'd be like, but those are the types of things that ultimately only you and your spouse can work out. And while the applications that, or the situations and the relationship that I have with Jennifer is ultimately going to be somewhat different than what you have with your spouse, you have the same responsibility to think about what the uniqueness is within your relationship and to apply these same ideas. Billy.
I think what you mentioned, what everybody's mentioned here, is important. We've
some who are about to be married, and it is important to know what Rod's talking about, that your spouse can forgive you. We're not able to truly forget, in the sense that that damage, and I know I keep saying it, but this deposits and withdrawals idea that I was told a long time ago, that the relationship is a system of deposits and withdrawals, and you need to make a lot more deposits than you make withdrawals. There's a lasting effect, and the longer you make that happen, the longer those negative interactions go on in the same way, they will eventually, even if you change later, then you have to deal with that old momentum, that old baggage that's there. It's, first of all, it's almost impossible to get the momentum going the other direction. And then even if you do, there's at least going to be a period of sunshine next time your spouse is apart, where they're thinking, well, when's the shoe going to drop? You know, when's this going to go back to the old? You know, so it's just super important that we try our best. Nobody's perfect, but take seriously these interactions and try our best to find positive ways to interact with each other, to be humble, put each other first, to truly try to be on the same track with each other, because
trying to repair damage is difficult, and after about so much damage is done, it takes a huge momentum shift to even get things going, like you said. But then to actually repair, if it's years of damage that have been done, that's not easy, Sean.
Say you're sorry, that you do produce something to show that you're sorry. But now what we're also saying is that, having said that, there's sometimes scars that are left. And so could you kind of maybe comment on, you know, how does that look like whenever you've got a thing that's happened in the marriage, and you're told, let's say the man's at fault, you know, forgive me. And how does the wife navigate that? Because is there also something he said that there's a realistic expectation that she should be seeing fruits of repentance of that while she gains that trust, but also that complexity of honoring that sincerely. You know what I'm talking about?
No, you're hitting real close to home. So there have been times where I was at fault. And I will tell you, sometimes I'm not the first person to say I'm sorry. I work on that. And so there have been times where I've said, I'm sorry. Well, that's my get out of jail free card. But to her, until I show the fruits of not only am I telling you, I'm vocalizing that I'm sorry, but maybe I'm not acting like I'm sorry. And so until she sees true contriteness, true regret, and I either change behavior or demonstrate the next time whatever happened that I behaved differently, until I show that, it's not easy for her just to go, oh, okay, you said you're sorry, it's good. And I have been guilty of being emotionally dishonest by saying, I'm sorry. Maybe I really wasn't, but I was saying it so that she has nothing to bear against me anymore. Well, I've said, I'm sorry. You have to forgive. And I think we as spouses, we know each other so well, just body language, the way we say things, tone, whatever you want to call it. Hopefully you have that instinctual feel with your spouse. You know when they're being honest with you. And Jennifer can tell if my apology is insincere. It's hard to fake it. They know you. They know you too well. And so when you give that apology and they know that it's not sincere and you don't have the actions behind it, it creates problems. Does that kind of...
Yeah, and so what I'm hearing you say too, the husband should, if we're guilty of that, we should allow her the time. In other words, she kind of has to, we have to earn a trust again.
Right.
If we've been transgressing and it's appropriate for her to say, listen, I love you, but you need to show fruit.
Right. Absolutely. Billy. That's right. And that's what's so difficult. And when, she's made mistakes, I've made mistakes. It's very difficult when you're the person that you feel like has been offended to carry out your God-given responsibility. I am still to love her. She's done something that I see very unlovely, in my opinion. And when I do something to her that is offensive, it is very difficult to respectfully submit in that moment. It's very hard to carry on your responsibility that God has given you, but yet that's what we're commanded to do. So we've got about 5 minutes left, and we're going to close the idea of authority, and we're going to move on. I believe our next lesson is going to be on carrying love within the husband-wife relationship. But let's look at the results. What's the big picture? All these things we've talked about, what is the result? We know that God created woman to be man's companion, and it was good. We know that Eve was God's gift to Adam, and that's what this relationship should look like. It shouldn't be a relationship of contention, of discord. That's not the way God meant it. And yet, so many people have not followed the wisdom that he gave of how to conduct this relationship, that that's what it's turned into. I mean, we know that women have been told in our society that they should be free of authority from any man. You shouldn't be under the rule of any man. You have the right to be free to exercise your own free will. You know, the man shouldn't be holding you down. Basically, the idea of no one to rule over you. We talked briefly about the idea of what that looks like. We can use the example of in Judges, right? When constantly there was no law. It was anarchy. And while that was on a national scale, you can scale it down and look at the family. When no one's in charge, there is chaos. And so the idea that the woman is any lesser because she accepts a role of submission, it's a lie that has been perpetuated throughout our society. In the end, the results of a successful and God-pleasing husband-wife relationship are God is pleased. If you look in 1 Peter chapter 3, we've gone to this passage, verses 1 through 7. A woman who has this quiet and gentle spirit does what for God? Pleases him. And a man who treats his wife with respect and as a weaker vessel, his prayers are not hindered. These are things that are pleasing to God. God is honored. Again, in 1 Peter chapter 2, the idea in that context, before he even gets to chapter 3 and is talking about the husband-wife relationship, the entire passage is about how God's servants can be honorable among men. He even talks about in the idea, especially in the first part of that chapter, the husband is not a believer and probably isn't a real nice guy. And yet, when a woman submits and holds herself in the manner in which God asks her to, that God is honored in that relationship. The wife is honored. We looked at Proverbs chapter 31 about the woman and the wise woman and how she is honored. Her family rises up and blesses her and honors her. The family is honored. We looked at several Proverbs. We also looked at 1 Timothy 3 and 1 Peter 3. The family is honored. The unit that God created, his God, the God-given pattern, the family is honored. We mentioned at the very outset of this study, of all of the societal, of the empires throughout time that have faltered, what was the reason? At the core, why did those empires fail? Because the family unit broke down. And so when God's family is honored, there's a national honor. It's bestowed throughout the community. It's all based on this one family unit. It's devastating to a husband when his wife doesn't respect him. And it is devastating to a wife when her husband does not love her. And I don't know any way to get around that. That's the way it is. And yet, counterpoint, there is nothing more beautiful than a husband-wife relationship that follows the pattern that God has established. I can tell you in my experience, I would not trade my relationship with Jennifer for anything on this earth. It's a beautiful thing to me. Do we argue? Do we fuss? Do we fight? We have. Have we? And all of those reasons, if we're not following the pattern, that's where the problem comes in. It's not because God gave us this relationship that just inherently has problems. It's when we get away from the pattern that we have problems. But you know what? I'm not alone in this life. I have a companion. And that's what God wanted for me. And that's what he wanted for her. And so when we follow the pattern that God has given us, it's beautiful. And we probably are all sitting here thinking of people we've known that have been married for 50 years or 60 years or however long it is. And you know, I think about my parents. They've been married, 57 years, I forget how many. My grandparents were married 60-something years. The only time I ever saw my grandfather cry was the day that my grandmother died. He wasn't an emotional guy, but their relationship was beautiful. And that's what God wants for us, but we have to follow his pattern to make that happen. We are out of time. Thank you so much.
Yeah. You don't talk to me like that.